Hello, and welcome to another installment of the S&C podcast series, S&C Critical Insights. I'm Benjamin Weber, a partner in the firm's New York office and a member of the Commercial Real Estate Group. I'm here today with Jason Wasser, an associate in our New York office and also a member of the Commercial Real Estate Group.
Today, we will provide an overview of a basic deed in lieu transaction and highlight certain considerations to keep in mind from the perspective of borrower and its counsel. The COVID pandemic and the resulting impact on commercial tenants is causing many landlords to reevaluate their equity positions in their commercial real estate portfolios. This program is a brief refresher for landlords that are thinking of walking away from a loan secured by a commercial property. Benjamin, perhaps you could start with a brief reminder of the basic premise that underlies our discussion of deed in lieu transactions.
Thank you, Jason. You're right. It's useful to remember the basic premise of non-recourse mortgage debt, at least in the commercial context. That is, if the borrower and its owners determine for any reason the borrower no longer has meaningful equity in a mortgage property, one option is to turn in the keys and walk away. That's the basic bargain of a non-recourse loan. While in a time of crisis, a lender might be rueing its original judgment, the lender in non-recourse financing, which is a typical form of commercial mortgage debt, has agreed, absent outright fraud and so long as the borrower is observing specific guidelines, for example, it's not committing waste, misappropriating rents, the borrower's maximum exposure for failure to repay debt is the loss of collateral. A deed in lieu transaction is a borrower and a lender acknowledging and implementing that feature of the financing. Implicit in my statement is the idea that unlike the borrower of a personal loan or even a home mortgage loan, this borrower negotiated for the right to be able to walk away and not suffer an adverse stigma for exercising that right. Of course, in reality, there can be negative stigma, or at least a knock on business reputation for a company or for principals that have been unable or unwilling to repay a mortgage loan. So you can't take this mere exercise of rights principle too far. The walkaway right is at the foundation of the deed in lieu transaction. If the borrower's management has gotten their mind around the idea that they're going to lose the mortgage property in foreclosure, it can be in their interest to offer smooth, cooperative transition. And in some cases, the lender might even be willing to grant certain accommodations to a borrower in recognition of the value of that cooperation. Essentially, the borrower team offers to take the time and expense and uncertainty of a judicial proceeding off the table. And in exchange, they get finality of transaction. Examples of lender accommodations include perhaps a clear affirmation of no surviving liability, or at least a covenant not to sue the borrower, speed of action, which can minimize distraction and residual fallout for the borrower, and potentially a chance to preserve some level of reputational credit from what was otherwise a bad situation.
What are some of the main things a borrower should do or consider doing if it's thinking of proposing a deed in lieu transaction?
So I should start with the general warning that every deed in lieu transaction has its own characteristics. The property, the relative leverage of the parties in the transaction, whether the borrower was an SPE or whether it has other assets, the terms of the loan, all of this has to be taken into consideration. But for our discussion today, let's focus on a simple single asset commercial mortgage financing with an SPE borrower and no pending construction. The fact that I have to even make that clarification highlights the importance of evaluating your situation carefully to determine if you qualify or if there are variations in your loan, such as multiple properties, multiple borrowers, the inclusion of a recourse guarantee, or other potential triggering events that warrant special attention. So the starting point for an analysis of how to proceed is to gather and have counsel read all the loan documents. It'll be important to get a fresh understanding of the terms of the loan and the security package with attention to the various default and remedy provisions that, frankly, people tend to ignore when they're negotiating loan documents because optimism is high at the outset. But of course, now we're looking at a distress situation and these features will all come into play. In doing this, look in particular for documents like guarantees, indemnities, and other credit support, some of which might survive a deed in lieu transaction. So there are basically three principles I want to talk about. The first one is recourse liability. One very common feature in a commercial mortgage loan, and this requires early and careful attention, is the non-recourse carve-out guarantee, sometimes also known as a bad boy guarantee. I know I've been emphasizing the non-recourse nature of these financings, but the name is a little bit deceiving because even in non-recourse financing, there are certain liabilities and risks that the lender wouldn't accept. They're covered in a sponsor guarantee that's known as the non-recourse carve-out guarantee. This agreement is included specifically to minimize the likelihood of the borrower taking certain actions when faced with distress. So to deter principals who control the borrower from causing the borrower to take actions that would impair the lender's ability to realize on the collateral. In a non-recourse carve-out guarantee, a creditworthy sponsor or parent has agreed that it will have affirmative liability to the lender for harm caused by certain bad acts, things like fraud or intentional waste. And more importantly, that the sponsor will have full recourse. In other words, will become liable for the entire amount of the loan upon certain specified triggers. A classic example of this is if the sponsor permits the borrower to make a voluntary bankruptcy filing. So once you've identified this guarantee, and it almost always exists in commercial mortgage financing, you have to look at it closely and carefully study what are the triggers for liability. For the borrower team, you have to be prepared to, once you've identified them, to comply with them. So for example, do not admit in writing the inability to pay debts as they come due. That is frequently, almost always, a trigger for full recourse under the non-recourse liability provisions. Don't misapply or misappropriate rents or other collateral, by which I mean make sure that the rents are following the normal path that's provided for in the loan documents. Don't fail to comply with the special purpose covenants if your loan documents have them. Make sure you're continuing to pay for insurance and taxes out of funds that are available, therefore. So generally speaking, operate the business in a way that minimizes the likelihood of violating the terms of the loan. Now, when you study these recourse liability provisions, a mistake in the drafting or a failure to comply with the terms of the guarantee can have dramatic consequences in your ability to have a clean walkaway. Another element, which I've already alluded to, it's a potential pitfall, this business of reputation. I know I've said that there's no shame in exercising your walkaway right, but if you expect to continue to go to the capital markets for commercial mortgage debt in the future, you do need to keep in mind that lenders in their KYC analysis routinely ask questions about prior defaults and also about prior deed in lieu transactions. So if you go down this path, you will be creating in your own record and for the record of the sponsors in your deal, an example that will be questioned in future financings. Anticipate having to answer those questions. All right, another topic past recourse liability and reputation is costs. Even though the borrower at this point is walking away from the property, walking away from the loan, you do need to recognize that there are costs that have to be covered. And if the borrower has no net cash flow, or if all of the revenue from the property is being absorbed in a lockbox or cash trap system, the money has to come from some external source. Here's some examples of the costs that arise in a deed in lieu transaction: transfer tax. You know, sometimes I think borrowers lose sight of the fact that even though this is not your traditional negotiated sale of a property, that tax is due. And in New York, it's a healthy New York City altogether, 3.275% of value or percent of the loan amount, not an inconsequential amount of money. And somebody has to pay it. If the borrower slash seller doesn't have the funds, the lender will have to absorb it. And it's important to be aware that that's going to be one of the numbers the lender is evaluating on its ledger. The cost of counsel and other advisors. If you're not able to manage this process entirely from internal staff, you have to recognize that those service providers are only going to work for a fee. They're not going to work for an entity that's in the middle of giving back its only asset. If you've got reserves, if you've posted reserves and there are escrowed funds with the lenders, recognize that in a deed in lieu transaction, the loan papers probably provide that those stay with the lender, that money leaves the system. There can be a significant income tax impact, and this is something to study before you make the decision whether you're going to walk away. If you have very low basis in a property, you may find that the mere act of giving it back in exchange for forgiveness of the debt triggers significant gain. A more esoteric point is that in New York, of course, borrowers, property owners, routinely preserve mortgage recording tax. They keep it alive by doing an assignment of debt. If you hand back the property in a deed in lieu transaction, the recording tax will be lost. You, of course, won't have the benefit of any more, and neither will the lender in a subsequent sale. So that's an element of the economic leakage. And finally, as a cost, you do lose control of the property. So to the extent that you have indemnities or guarantees that don't expire, that won't end upon the transfer, you also won't be able to manage the property in a way that minimizes the expenses arising out of them.
And once the borrower team has weighed these considerations and decided that it still wants to walk away from the property, how should they go about initiating the process of negotiating with lender?
That's an important thing to understand. Somebody has to take the lead. And it's worth spending some time to develop the messaging and develop a strategy for how you'll approach the lender. My recommendation is to be direct. Reach out to your best point of contact and do it on a business-to-business level. I know there's a tendency to say, oh, well, let's get the lawyers to talk. But frankly, this kind of transaction, at least at the outset, it's important for the messaging to come through on the business level. Don't be surprised if you approach the lender and the first thing you find out is, oh, they have to talk to their lawyers and they want something we've seen a lot of here in the last couple of months, a pre-negotiation letter. They'll want to have a document that specifies that we're going to have conversations and that neither of us can use information that's exchanged or points of view that are expressed against the other if our discussions fall apart and we somehow end up in an adverse situation. My advice to you is to be open to the idea. You may even view it as positive because it enables you to then speak quite frankly with the borrower or with the lender's team about what's happening without running the risk of inadvertently saying we don't have the money to pay and therefore being accused of having, quote unquote, admitted the inability to pay debts as they come due. Remember, that's that trigger to recourse. The other thing I would say is ease into the discussion. Don't lead with all the things you want, but do make sure you get them on the table. Acknowledge that the property's in distress and get the message across that you're willing to cooperate and make a smooth transition, allow the lender to take the collateral in exchange for speed and reasonable releases. There's a bargain here and you should recognize it. You don't necessarily have to rubber the lender's face in it, but you should recognize that the lender's opportunity here is for a quick, smooth transaction. They don't have to go through foreclosure, which frankly could take a year, 18 months, even longer when the courts are clogged. And they don't have to deal with the uncertainty of a judicial process or the possibility that along the way, other creditors of the property owner end up putting the borrower or the property owner into bankruptcy, which would really mess the works up for a mortgage lender. The lender will also presumably be claiming unfettered access to the escrowed funds and other reserves. They'll minimize their counsel fees. Taking another year and a half to fight through a foreclosure process does take money and it erodes the value of the property that would otherwise be available to the lender. You minimize disruption to the property and uncertainty at a property can cause it to lose position in the market, and that ultimately doesn't inure to the lender's benefit either. Ultimately, a quick resolution will accelerate the lender's ability to get in control of the property and to begin repositioning it and marketing it for sale, because I think the working presumption is here that lenders are not really in the business of owning these types of collateral. On the borrower side, the things that the borrower has to offer, remember, this is a bargain, so the borrower is telling the lender, these are the things that are good for you. Other things the borrower has to offer to sweeten the pot, if you will, are easy access to extensive property information, agreement to refrain from taking certain permitted actions during a window of time prior to the transfer, sharing intellectual capital, open discussions about business, strategy, relationships with tenants, potentially even post-closing cooperation a borrower could offer to continue to make itself available after the deed, and potentially a sponsor entity could make representations about the transaction that give the lender confidence about what he's doing. The borrower team, who we're talking now about strategy, developing a plan, the borrower team should appoint a spokesperson, and they should maintain clear, consistent messaging. Borrowers should be proactive. They should be reaching out, engaging with the lender, and trying to establish a positive rapport. They should be cooperative. Now, so far, it's all give, 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 cooperate, cooperate, cooperate. You do have to do this in a guarded way. You have to remember that the transaction could break down. Things could potentially become adversarial. And so you may want to lead with strong points, but hold back other things until you feel like you're developing the right relationship. This is important. Be prepared to consider and respond to alternate proposals. The lender may come back to you and say, I don't want to own the property yet. Can't we work something out? maybe the lender will say, I'll make protective advances, or even I'll grant an increase in the loan amount, and we'll use that money to work through this difficult time, and let's cooperate together to find a buyer for the property. By the way, doing that would avoid the need to pay transfer tax twice, once on transfer to the lender, and then again when the lender ultimately sells the property. The lender also might just offer to give forbearance and to extend the loan. And I think a borrower group needs to be open to this and try to find the path that will get to the ultimate resolution. As I was saying, be guarded. One thing to be mindful of is that these conversations with the lender might be going just fine, but the lender always has as an option to sell the loan. And I think you should assume that the lender will explore that as a possibility. And if the lender does sell the loan, you might suddenly wake up and find that you're dealing with a completely different actor, and an actor that has a very different strategy in mind, potentially even one that wants to go back and mine ambiguities in that non-recourse carve-out document to see whether they can make the borrower team and its sponsors uncomfortable enough to extract other concessions. So you have to find the right balance. You have to recognize that while the passage of time can hurt the collateral, and so it might seem to work to a borrower's favor, it also doesn't really help to let things linger too long. Be flexible so that if an opportunity arises to make a deal, you're open to consider it. An amicable solution is probably going to be your best option in this scenario.
Would you walk through some of the other considerations that a borrower should keep in mind when preparing to turn the keys back to lender?
Yeah, so at the risk of being repetitive, plan ahead, get yourself organized. In many ways, what you're about to do is just like if you were selling the property outright. So figure out, do you have all the records at hand? Don't just stumble into this thing. Make sure you're going to be able to react promptly and accurately to requests for information. It's quite possible the lender will want to conduct a full due diligence review. They've been collecting interest payments. They've been monitoring the reporting on this loan, but that's different than thinking about actually owning the underlying property. Also, don't assume the lender already has everything. I've heard borrowers say this so often, oh, we've been giving this to them for years. It may be a different group within the borrower. It's quite possible within the lender, and it's quite possible that the lender might choose to engage new counsel who will have to learn a lot of this over again. So be prepared to engage in a give and take and share information with your lender group. Some of the things that you would want to prepare and have ready to give out: your survey, your title policy and links to the underlying documents, a current rent roll and a delinquency report, information about expected TI and leasing costs, copies of all the leases and the guarantees, the letters of credit. You have to dig all this stuff out. Status of leasing activity, your management agreement, your service contracts, recent tax bills, utility bills, municipal violations. This is always a treat when you start digging around to figure out whether you've got any pending violations in the municipality. You'll find examples of hearings that somebody didn't even know about or attend, and fines that were levied potentially years ago that have just been accumulating. Find all that stuff. If possible, clean some of it up in anticipation of a smooth transaction. If you have them, dig out your most recent third-party reports, environmental report, physical condition report, a zoning report, information about ADA compliance. Obviously, you'll have your current budget. You could request from your insurance carrier a claims history so you could show what kind of accidents and insurance claims have been at the property. Information about pending litigation, estoppel certificates from primary tenants if you've received them, contracts with unions, information about your employees, all of this stuff. Be prepared to accumulate it and have it accessible. The volume may be overwhelming. Think about potentially putting it in a virtual data site. Take a little bit of time to confirm that you don't need, or if you did need, that you already have any consents that would be necessary to transfer all this collateral over to the lender or to the lender's designee. And as you assemble the materials, keep an eye out if there are examples where you find that you're inadvertently in default of provisions of the loan agreement, at least to know them so that the lender's team, when they find them, won't be surprising you. And if there's an easy fix, potentially to cure them before they come to light. Does the borrower group and the sponsor rely on any affiliate for services, for property management or leasing or some other service at the building? And if so, what's supposed to happen with that relationship at the time of the deed in lieu? Dig that out. Think about how you want to pitch that to the lender, or maybe how the loan documents already specify that will be handled. Are there items of personal property, artwork, particular furniture, a founder's desk or something that was excluded from the collateral? Go find out where that stuff is. Think about what you're going to do in connection with the transfer in lieu. Is there intellectual property? Is a parent or a related company lending its trademark or other branding for use at the property? And assess what's supposed to happen with that. Remember, all these things can take time and either preparation on your part and on the lender's part to evaluate them and to figure out what they want to do. The lender, while you'll be encouraging them to move quickly for certainty at the property, will probably be inclined to move relatively slowly while they try to understand all of this information. Jason, you've asked me a lot of questions, and I think we've covered a lot of the basics of what happens in these transactions. Let's turn things around. You have worked through a few of these transactions. In your experience, what are the key documents? What are the agreements and other instruments that the parties typically see in a transaction like this?
Well, much of the documentation is similar to what you'd see in a straight sale. So prior to negotiating the deed in lieu agreement, I would recommend that the parties negotiate an LOI or non-binding term sheet to outline the major deal points up front and avoid future misunderstandings. The documents delivered at closing would include the deed and also a general assignment of leases, transfer tax forms, and authorization documents. Lender will also most likely request that the mortgagor deliver a seller's affidavit in connection with lender's purchase of title insurance at closing. And for the most part, these documents would not differ too substantially from the form that they would take in a straight sale, but there are differences. So for instance, the deed would generally include a no merger clause, providing that the parties intend for the mortgage not to merge into the fee interest being conveyed at closing. And while we would always advise a seller to deliver as narrow a seller's affidavit as possible, there are certain things that a seller would ordinarily cover in a straight sale that the seller's affidavit should not cover in a deed in lieu transaction. The affidavit should generally not cover mechanics liens, for example, consistent with the premise that lender is taking title to the property as is. And while lender's counsel may ask for a closing opinion, the value of an enforceability opinion is, of course, questionable when all of the standard creditor's rights and bankruptcy exceptions are in play, and borrower's counsel would ordinarily push back on that request for those reasons. The main transaction document is the deed in lieu agreement itself. While this document's not strictly necessary in order to transfer the property to lender, both parties will often enter into this agreement to memorialize the circumstances of borrower's walkaway and some of the deal points that you discussed above. So lender will ask for a release of claims against it, and it's important for borrower to secure a release as well. Depending on the circumstances, lender may prefer to give a covenant not to sue borrower rather than a release, so as to avoid the potential unintended extinguishment of the mortgage lien, and therefore lose the right to subsequently foreclose and terminate subordinate encumbrances. And this may be acceptable to borrower depending on the scope of the covenant. And then last, the parties may enter into a transition agreement whereby borrower would aid in the orderly transition of the property to lender's ownership. Despite the underperformance of the asset, borrower still often has more experience with managing commercial properties generally, as well as a deep familiarity with the particular property and how to navigate through its records. And the promise of continuing aid for a period after closing can be an additional inducement to lender the relief borrower seeking in a deed in lieu transaction as well.
Great. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate that review. That pretty much concludes our overview. There are a lot of subtle nuances to a transaction like this. So I repeat my advice that it's important to plan ahead, to develop a strategy, to understand the terms that you're confronted with, and then get right into the transaction and see if you can get the benefit of your bargain. Thank you very much for listening.